All right, folks, 2 Corinthians. We ended up at 2 Corinthians 5:21. My remarkable memory told me. I asked Debbie.
If you can't see the printed egg, you're blind.
2 Corinthians 5:21.
That's really where we ended.
Oh, yeah, this is perfect.
That's got a nice shape.
2 Corinthians 5:21.
Come on, Debbie, you should be there.
2 Corinthians 5, we're in verse 21.
We're not far.
Have we stopped at 1 Corinthians?
2 Corinthians 5, verse 21. Now, I'm going to read the verse again. We ended up on that. But it says this, "For he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him." Now, here's that great trade-off. Now, I always go back to that thing when Abraham Lincoln was running for office the first times back in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, and such. There used to be a tradition in those times that politicians would get together and publicly debate. And, of course, it would be usually county fair-type atmospheres and such. And one of the games they would play, and it was all for fun, was the idea that you would do a horse trade to show who was the best and the most honest politician. And so, sight unseen, you would bring a horse and trade it with the other politician. But the real joke was you tried to bring the worst horse you possibly could. And that was the big joke. And this one particular time, when Lincoln was running for Congress, the politician against him brought what everybody thought was the worst neck they'd ever seen. I mean, bow back and ribs all showing, this really old horse that probably should have been put out of its misery, and they're waiting. Well, Abraham Lincoln came walking down the road with a sawhorse. And, and everybody loved that. You know, that he just always had a way of one-upping. But, of course, it was a terrible trade. Now, the worst trade ever made in history is the one right
That's
here.
That's right, brother. Yes, sir.
Okay? Where there's Jesus Christ who never knew sin. Never had an idea what sin was like. And God made him to be sin. And we were made the righteousness of God in him. Now that's the trade.
That's the trade.
Now, keep this in mind. It doesn't say that you were given the righteousness of God. You were made the righteousness of God. So that God could look in the new man of a person. This could be a person who'd been robbing banks the night before. This could be a person who's the most vile person in the world and such. At the moment they repent, trust the Lord, then suddenly that person becomes his righteousness. Where the Lord looks and says, "Now that's my righteousness right there. That's my right." The world's not going to see it that way. Okay? You ask everybody in the world what the righteousness of God is, and they've got 1,000 different definitions. God has a definition. It's that person that he has cleansed with his death, burial, and resurrection. Right. That's the definition of his righteousness. All right. Now, in fact, that's why Paul says they being ignorant of God's righteousness, they don't understand what it is, go about to establish their own righteousness. That's what religion does, where you're going around and trying to do this or that. And, you know, now most of you, I think, see this better. But why would God be interested in somebody facing a certain direction and saying those same words 42 times? Like, you know, what is God? Some kind of a robot or something? You know, why would that interest God? Why would it interest God if somebody went ahead and bowed a certain way in front of a statue? You know, what is God? Some kind of an idiot? That's not going to do a single thing. Instead, how's God communicate with men? Well, it communicates for rational thought and words. That thing that makes men different than animals. And so when he makes them righteous, he's going to make them righteous with his words, with his promises. He does something for men they can't do themselves. But men can't understand that, so they try to make up their own rules of how to be righteous. So that I really said that to launch into chapter 6. We then, as workers together with him, beseech you also that you receive not the grace of God in vain. So, that word beseech, begging you. He said, all right, we're workers together. And It's interesting here. He doesn't say we're workers together for God. We work together with God. Mm-hmm. Okay. What does the Lord want? What is he doing? I'll work with him. Sammy Illinois used to use the illustration of, he said, if you're in the train and you look out and you see two tracks, one's what God does, one's what man does.
Bless you.
Here's man's responsibility, here's God's. You know you're on track. We can see them both. If you ever wake up and can only either see what God does or what man does, you're off the track. You're not where you need to be. It's that idea of realizing you work with God. And so it's a matter of trying to find out, oh, what's the Lord want? What does God want? Okay, what does he want? Well, if I was going to find out what he wanted, I'm going to go find rational words written down in a language I can understand that are holy, make my life better, show me how to live. So he says then again, we then as workers together with him beseech you also that you receive not the grace of God in vain. There's God's grace out there. And there's people who receive it. And this is really what's talked about in those Proverbs where it talks about a man sowed and they received the word. But it couldn't be fruitful. It couldn't do anything. Okay, it was just all in vain. It didn't do a bit of good. So he says in verse 2, now if you notice, it's in parentheses. Now what that means is this. Parentheses are any time that there's a thought within a thought. Okay? Let me use an example of that. I want you guys to go out by the barn, the red one, and tie the dog up. Do you hear that thought within a thought? If I was writing that, I can put that in parentheses. Okay? I want you guys to go to the church, the one your mother and I worked so hard on, and, you know, put these hymnals there. It's a thought within a thought. Parentheses would be a proper way to put that. So here, and what that means is if we took the parentheses out and read it without it, it would make sense. So just, we're going to do that for a moment. Well, let's read verse 1 and then to verse 3. We then as workers together with him beseech you also that you receive not the grace of God in vain, giving no offense in anything, that the ministry be not blamed. See how that worked together? It went right along. But there's a thought within a thought, and you have to stop and look at that. Something he wants to think you to think about. He says, For as he saith, I have heard thee, and a time accepted, and the day of salvation have I succored thee. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. So he's quoting out of the book of Isaiah. He quotes that word succored there. It's not S-U-C-K-E-R-E-D, like I'm a con man, boy, didn't I sucker you. All right?
It's like you're saying, though, right?
Well, it's not suckle. That's close again. Succored is to send help. Okay? Succored there, Succored, I've heard it pronounced, but it means to send help. I've succored thee. I've sent help to thee. Okay, I brought you help when you didn't have any. Now, there's a man who no one knows his name, but everybody knows a book written about him. The book Robinson Crusoe was written about a real person. And it was written about a guy who was from Scotland, and he had a horrible temper. All his teachers knew he had a terrible temper. His mother knew he had a terrible temper. His mother used to try to drag him to church. He wanted nothing to do with it. He'd cuss anybody, anytime, anywhere. And so he actually went to sea and had his chest, and he actually went as an officer on a British sailing ship. And they sailed into what's called the Spanish Main. They went out of British waters, and they're down by the coast of South America, and they're sailing down there. And what that meant, and this is the early 1700s, if he's caught, the Spanish will kill every single Englishman on that ship. They're totally outnumbered. They're out behind enemy lines when you're there. The wealth is unbelievable if you get away with this, if you can go and raid a couple Spanish ships or something. So they're out there, and they stop at a place called Ferdinand Island, and which had like a hill on it, unpopulated island, but it had a fresh river on it, where they could get fresh water. So the British stop there, they hunt, shoot a couple of goats, get some fresh meat, get some fresh water. And on that island, and everybody's in a great mood and all this kind of thing, but the guy has a terrible argument with the captain. And he finally screams at him, "I wouldn't sail on a ship like this. I'd rather be on this island than be sailing a ship with you." Next thing he knows, the captain gave him his choice. You know, this is what you wanted. And he later told the story watching that ship sail off. And he's on an island in the midst of enemy country. And might be years before anybody even sails to this island again. You're dealing in the early 1700s. And he watches that last rowboat take off. And the rowboat had actually brought his chest of goods. And he panicked, he's screaming after him. He watches the ship go and realizes that guy ain't come back for him. He cussed that captain, said he wanted to be alone. So he panicked for a while, and then he realized, I've got to do something. So he went and found a cave, dragged his chest in there, and tried to find stuff to eat. And he found, I remember, pimentos growing there and different things. And so he begins to unpack his chest of goods. There was a book, for example, on all the most modern sailing techniques known in the early 1700s. But it told you how to read a sextant, how to read exactly where you were by the stars. So it's in a book, but very few sailors had ever really read that. But it actually explains all these things. And, you know, his mother had then he found a Bible, and he actually cussed his mother when he found the Bible. You know, you put that in here and such. But later on, you know, he ended up spending, I think, close to 5 years on that island. And, you know, absolutely by himself. So he read everything inside out. At one point, for example, he saw a ship coming. He's all excited. He runs down to the shore and realizes they're Spanish. They would have killed him in a heartbeat. So he has to run back on the Spanish chasing. But by that time, he was as lithe as a mountain goat, and he got away from them and such. They hunted him for a while and finally left again, probably with a legend of a madman on that island. But he got to the point he could chase a goat down and catch it. I mean, that's how, you know, and he stayed alive that way. But he read this verse. "For he saith, I have heard thee in a time accepted, the day of salvation have I succored thee. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation." And he just remembered. He thought, well, how did I get here? Oh, yeah, my temper. That thing that nobody could ever cure me of. And he just sat there and totally ashamed and met the Lord there on that island. And God had finally brought him to repentance, showed him his real self. Vile person, you're here because of you and what you are. And it was like after 5 years of being there, he saw a British ship coming up. And they landed. He came on down there and killed some goats, brought everybody's in amazement. He's talking absolutely in his right mind and such. He talks to the sea captain. The sea captain didn't have a first mate. He explained, well, I know all the newest techniques. I mean, he'd read the book. They sailed, plundered the Spanish main, came back with the equivalent of billions of dollars. And he lived the rest of his life as a saved man in a church in Scotland. And but he met the Lord with this verse there, right? And it was Daniel Defoe met him, heard his story, and wrote the story Robinson Crusoe. All right. So he said, I've heard thee in accepted time, the day of salvation. And why is Paul quoting that from the Old Testament? He's trying to show that God reaches out to men. It's one of the things God does. God reaches out to men. Now verse 3. He's talking about receiving not the grace of God, giving no offense in anything, that the ministry be not blamed. Okay. Now, almost everywhere you go, when I first got to this town, you just cannot believe the stories I heard in house after house after house of 50 years of people who'd been offended by this church. Okay? One way or another, absolutely. And it's like Lucille Lawton told me. She said the grudges go back to the 1950s. Some of them are just people twisting stuff around for their own good. Some are some awful things that went on. Okay? Over the years, some terrible things that went on. And It's really where the thing the Lord showed me, that if you're going to get people in this church, you're not going to get people who are used to this church. You're going to have to go out here into the highways and hedges and compel people to come in and find people who don't have church and don't know anything about the house of God, and find people completely, who don't know anything of the past of this church and the battles and the wars. I could stand with my back to this church and throw a stone and hit houses of people that still hate this church. Okay? I mean, hate it. Just absolutely mad at things that have gone on and such. And so that's why the Lord says here, giving no offense in anything, that the ministry be not blamed. Okay?
Well, there's another part in 1 Corinthians where Paul tells us that we too hastily go to court with one another instead.
Yeah, too hastily, and he said your brother goeth to war with brother, and such, and those are always awful things. Here's what I've noticed: when Christians fight with each other, both of the strong parties will survive, but the new people and the weak are destroyed.
Oh yeah.
Okay. That's what happens when Christians fight with each other. And that's why it's so important that not happen. You know, you do everything you can to keep. Now, there comes a point you can't keep peace any longer. Okay? There comes a point when you absolutely have to make a stand or whatever, but you want to make sure that you have counted the cost, that you absolutely have done everything you can on every single level you know how not to make a war out of something. Verse 4, but in all things approving ourselves as the minister of God in much patience. Okay? Much patience. Absolutely patient constantly. Cliff Taylor says this. He said he doesn't know another ministry around the entire United States where a pastor is in a situation like I am here. And he always tells me, he said, Brother John, he said, I always commend your patience. He says, you put up with things there that no one would put up in any other church anywhere else. They just wouldn't put up with it. So far, it's been pretty easy. I mean, the Lord's made it pleasant, made it nice, and reward all along the way and such. But in much patience, in afflictions. Okay? Afflictions are going to come all the time. You're always going to have things where you're afflicted here, afflicted. You know, if suddenly a man gets salvation and then God lifted him up on some fairy cloud and he drifted through life and nothing ever went wrong, what's the Christian life in that? Okay. Instead, to take somebody and let them go through all the afflictions that everybody else goes through and then stand there and say, wow, he's handling that different. When the Apostle Paul first went onto the island of Melita, a serpent bites him, a viper bites him, and he shakes it off, and everybody, oh my goodness, he's going to die. But he didn't die. And that's when they said, oh, he's different. Okay? That man's different. And people will watch you, and they'll watch life getting you, and this going wrong, and that going wrong, and everything happening like that. And they'll realize, wow, he's different. Dr. Harold Seitler was a pastor of Tabernacle Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina from the 1940s until he died 5 or 6 years ago. And when he first took the church over, it was a failing church. He'd been there for a while, but it was failing. They couldn't pay the bills, couldn't do anything, and there's a lot of churches in that situation. And now let me tell you something. I have people here, you might be critical of some of the people who have been in this church a long time, but you have the grace of being in a church that doesn't have one dime of debt. Okay? I know a lot of pastors taking churches over and it's deep in debt and all this kind of trouble and that kind of stuff. So right off the bat, you need to stop and think about that. You know, what it means to be in a church that there's no debt. We're not out there, well, we got to pay the mortgage this month. You know, it's like, we don't have that. And by the grace of God, we don't have that. Right. So really ought to think about that. But Dr. Seitler was in that church, and for example, one time, and I think you've all heard me tell this story, they came to him and said, we don't have enough money for your salary this week. And what do you want us to do? And he said, I want you to take on a missionary. He said, whoa, we don't know. We said, we don't have enough money. And he said, no, you don't understand. We need to take on a missionary. And he said, that's why we don't have enough money, because God doesn't see it's worthwhile supporting. So the church trusted him, voted on a missionary, and somehow the next few months paid their bills and helped a missionary. So the next time a financial crisis came up, took another missionary. When Dr. Seitler died, they had over 300 missionaries they were sending at least $50 a month to, some of them more. Okay, and you know, Bill Randall was trained there. You know, and so and a lot of good men came out of there at one time. So it's that idea of handling things that way. But one of the things that happened to him when he hadn't been there an awful long time, standing in front of the church, church is over, you know, everybody talking pleasantly, wasn't it nice, and little kids going off to play, a car went out of control, spun in the road, and killed his six-year-old daughter in front of him. Okay? And they'd already been through everything you could possibly imagine. Him fighting and infighting and everything else. And Dr. Seitler just talked about just spitting on his heel when they pronounced her dead and walking back into his office and slamming the door and putting his head down on the table and realized he had finally could not take any more of this. What more do you want me to pay? There was a knock at the door. He ignored it. He could not believe anyone would be bothering. A knock at the door again. Finally said, go away. The knock still kept going. Finally said, come in. He said a young man he had never seen before stepped in. Said, are you Dr. Harold Seitler? He said, yes, I am. He said, I want to shake hands with a man who won't quit for anything. And he said he shook hands with him, and the young man left again, and he never saw that young man again, ever. He always believed in angel games. He always believed that. So it's one of those things where Paul says afflictions. What good is serving the Lord if he puts some bubble around you and nothing ever happens?
Right.
Okay? It's when you're going through what everybody else is going through and you're going through these things and suddenly you're not cursing and you're not tearing up and you're realizing, hey, God's going to take care of us and you're getting through this. That's when people realize you've got a real God. Not when you're living some existence where everything's just wonderful and some nirvana type of thing. That doesn't happen in real life. You're never going to come to a plane where it's all okay. You might reach planes where you'll have sanctuary for a while and rest for a while. But you'll never reach some plane where you say, oh, it's all good now. Okay? That's just not going to happen. So he said, in afflictions, in necessities. Now, what's necessities?
Things you don't need.
Well, the opposite, Randy. Necessities is things you do need. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I'm glad you tried. In necessities. How many times do you hear people preach that thing, my God shall supply all your needs? Okay? And that's not true. The verse says, my God shall supply all your need. One need, a spiritual need. If you're going to serve the Lord many times, you're going to do without things that you need. I've known missionaries to get angry and quit the field because they felt God didn't answer all their needs. Okay? Philippians says, my God shall supply all your need. And when you go back to the context, the need is the supply of the Spirit of Christ Jesus. That's the need. Okay? But if you were to go talk to a Christian pastor in a North Korean prison camp right now, as we talk right now, you think he has necessities? Okay? That's right. If you were to go right now and talk to a pastor at a Cuban prison camp, right now, as we talk, hasn't seen his family in 20 years, has no idea who raised his kids, what his wife's doing, you think he feels like God supplied everything he needs? Nope. You wouldn't think that. A lot of times things go on that you can't stand. But Paul says in necessities, where you're standing there and you need stuff and it's not there. But you know what? That's when everybody's looking at you the most. They want to know, is there anything to you? Is there anything to what you can do? You know, if you were out somewhere and you know, were afraid of terrorists and suddenly the United States Marines came up and you're so glad and they heard a gunshot and they all ran off. You know, what was that all about, you know? And that's the same way. You know, people go, hey, I'm the new Christian. I'm here to help you or whatever else. And then something terrible goes on in their life. They cry, run off. Okay? No, you want to see that person absolutely handle it anyway. Mm-hmm. Absolutely make it anyway. I always go back to 83, when we invaded Grenada. And I was living in South Carolina at the time. And I'll never forget them interviewing a girl who was brought off a C-130 in Charleston, who'd been a medical student in Grenada. And they said, what was it like there? And she said, well, for the last 2 weeks, my friends and I had been laying on the floor of our kitchen. We'd run out of food, and the mobs were running through the streets, screaming anti-American things, and raping American women. And we have been laying on our stomachs with guns shooting, everything else, hoping they won't come look in this house. And she said there was gunfire and the door kicked open and a big man stood there in uniform, and it was an American lieutenant. Said, pulled me up off the ground and shielded me with his body. And the two of us ran together with gunshots and brought me to a ship, put me on that ship. And she said, I was raised to hate the military, but I don't hate them anymore. Okay? Now, that's what it ought to be when a pastor comes into somebody's life. It ought to be when a Christian comes in and you say, I want to be a friend to you. I want to be a Christian friend to you. I want to, you know, going to be gunshots, going to be awful things, but they want to see that you're going to stick with them, protect them with your own life, and watch out for them. So in necessities, and then he says, in distresses. And you want to know something? Nobody can distress you like God can. You know, there's just nobody who can reach into your life and find the exact strings to pluck. So everybody can see what you're like in distress. And it's just going to go on. Then he goes on, he says, verse 5, in stripes. Many times the Apostle Paul took beatings, in imprisonments, in tumults. What's a tumult? When everybody's fists are flying and things are going on and people are screaming and everything's going on. By the grace of God, I hope we don't get that going on here, but I've never been in a group of people too long where it didn't happen. Okay? In labors. It's not an easy job to be a Christian. Booker T. Washington, one of my great American heroes, a man I just fervently love. I love reading about Booker T. Washington. He used to despise preachers. And the reason he despised preachers is he saw so many blacks trying to get out of work by becoming preachers. And Booker T. Washington believed in work. I mean work. He'd get out there and work himself. I mean he'd work. But he overheard two young men talking one time, and one said, you know, the sun is so hot and the cotton's so grassy, meaning so many weeds in it, I just know I'm called to preach. And he overheard one saying that, and he mocked that with all his heart. If you're going to serve the Lord, you're going to labor. You're going to work. You're going to get out there. It's not an easy job. Old John W. Peterson wrote that song, It's Not an Easy Road. Okay? In labors, in watchings. What is that? Watch and pray, keeping your eyes open, constantly watching, constantly looking. I don't think it's any secret. My kids have learned babysitting over there, constantly watching. Why? Because so many of the children that come in here have been already lost their innocency, already been exposed to sexual things. We're not angry at those children for that. And that happened to them. That was an awful thing that happened to them. So it's watching. They're trained, watch, watch, watch. I watch in this church all the time. Realize Hannah sat in the church on Wednesday, last night, had a 15-year-old girl sit next to her and say, I think I'm pregnant with my father's child. Okay? And Hannah knows there's no choice. She's going to call the authorities. That girl's going to think she's a traitor. She's going to think, but that's not the case, you know. She needs professional help. She needs intervention. That office right there. I've only been here 6.5 years. We ran into two women who sat in there, and both of them had children by their own fathers. Okay, and got each one the help that they needed. But it's watching. It's constantly having your eye. I watch for people all the time. There's things I always have to watch. The Bible talks about wolves amongst the flock. The word wolf is in the Bible 13 times in one form or another. Okay, number of the Antichrist. It's in there 13 times. You know what makes a wolf different than other animals? Is its sensitivity. Its ability to feel. So much so that in Indiana, where there's a federal reservation, where they raise baby bison and baby wolves in two different parts of the reservation, and they restock the wilderness with them. For example, the American bison is making a comeback because they'll raise those little calves and raise them and such. Doing the same with wolves and restocking certain areas and putting them out there. Well, here's what they've learned. They'll take a little baby bison, or they'll take some bison, and they're getting ready to put a herd out. And the last thing they want to do is put sickly animals out. They want to take only the most healthy, put stock out there. And they'll have veterinarians go over them and everything else, and they've learned one last trick. They put them in a pen, and they let the wolves out in the pen with them. Now, they're right there to protect them. They're going to keep anything from happening. And they say this, those wolves will walk around, and then all of a sudden, all the wolves sometimes will go around one bison and begin circling it. And they'll realize something's wrong with that bison. And they'll pull it in, keep it a week, and finally they'll discover the heart murmur. Some little thing that their veterinary science couldn't get, but those wolves knew it instantly. And you'll have people walk into this church and walk up, oh, what's wrong? Oh, is something wrong with you? You know, they're not treating you like they treat everybody else. And, you know, you'll have people, they're wolves, and they'll walk in, and immediately their empathy, they'll see, you know, this person's not getting this, and they're not getting that. It's a wolf. And they're in there to destroy. They're in there to hurt. We had a fractious budget meeting a week and a half ago. Fractious. Didn't get out of bounds, but it was fractious. Didn't get out of bounds. But somebody who never before in their life had ever called Tanya called her immediately the next morning, thinking maybe Tanya had heard all the rumors, okay? Who'd never called her before, ever. You know what I mean? And, you know, and just, hey, how are things going? And this and that. See, what is that? See, and you, so my eyes are constantly watching. What's going on? What's going on? What's going on here? What's going on there? Watching. Apostle Paul said it's just part of the ministry and watching. It's constantly watching that stuff. In fastings. Fasting's a tough thing to do, okay? Fasting something there where the Apostle Paul from time to time would do it. I remember when my wife and I sat in South Carolina and our family just absolutely destroyed and ruined. My ministry ruined. It just looked like there was no hope anywhere. And the two of us would get together. I've only fasted one time since I've been the pastor of this church. I haven't felt a need but one time. But I remember at that time, the two of us would say, we're going to take this day and fast. We're going to take this day and fast. It was in that period of time the Lord showed back to New York. Here's what you're going to do. Here's what you're going to do with this child. Here's what you're going to do with that child. And we just had to fast through each and every one of them and decide what the Lord wanted. And fasted until God absolutely made it clear, this is what you're going to do. I know people who maybe through hypoglycemia, something like that, they can't go a whole day without eating. Okay? There's a second type of fast. It's the one that Daniel talks about where he said, I ate no pleasant bread nor sweet meat. Didn't mean he didn't eat. But he just said to himself, I'm just going to eat very bland things through this period of time. You know, plain peanut butter sandwiches. I mean, now I have some other people here that's like a steak dinner to you, but you know, right. You know, but it's just sitting there eating absolutely bland stuff because you've got to go work, got to go do stuff, got to do whatever. So you're just going to get through that one way or another. But fasting's is part of the ministry. By pureness. And pureness is as close to the word holiness as you're going to find any synonym. It's as close. Keeping your life pure. Watching for all the stuff that wants to come in to overthrow your thoughts. And such. And it goes on all the time. I mean, it's just, I remember one time driving with my friend Mike Rizzuti, and we drove by a billboard for Hooters Restaurant. And he said to me, do you think anybody's ever noticed the plate of chicken? And I looked around, like, yeah, there is a plate of chicken in that. I'd never noticed it. but it's that old thing, you know, by pureness. You're keeping your... You want to mess your head up, get rid of your purity. You'll mess your head up, and you'll be on more antidepressants than you can shake a stick at. Not that that's the only reason that happens, but boy, it'll do it to you. Okay? By knowledge. Learning. By knowledge. You know, I've told you, I always have a history book open. I'm always learning somewhere. I'm always studying something. I'm always doing my best to learn something. Do that. You're never too old to learn stuff. Learn, okay? Homeschool, you actually learn a lot, don't you?
You learn something every day.
Yeah, homeschool your kid. It's amazing what you'll learn homeschooling, okay?
If all nothing this... else, patience.
Yeah. But isn't it amazing? Suddenly you never knew what a gerund was, and you never knew what this was or that was. And suddenly you start homeschooling, you have to look these words up.
I think I slept through elementary.
Yes, okay? By knowledge, by long suffering. Okay? What's long suffering? Well, that's that ability to put up with something over and over and over and over again. It goes back to that statement the Apostle Paul made in the book of Romans, where he said, as much as lieth in you, dwell peaceably with all men. Did he tell you to dwell peaceably with all men? No, he said, as much as lieth in you. Okay? Everybody here has a different threshold of where you've had all you can take. It is your honor to have the absolute longest, deepest threshold that you possibly could. Okay? It's to your honor to have that. The more you have a threshold for what you can put up with, the more beloved you will be in life. The less your threshold is, the more despised you will be in life. Okay? It's just the way it goes. Having a long, long threshold, being able to put up with stuff for a long period of time does not make you a fool. It does not make you a washover. It does not make you somebody that everybody's walking on. It makes you a beloved person. But you also have to know, like Popeye used to say, that's all I can stands, and I can't stands no more, and he popped the spinach, okay? And when Popeye ate the spinach, you better hope you wasn't one of the bad guys, all right?
Good old Popeye.
That's right. Popeye's going to take care of it. So the thing is, do your best. You know, what's a runner do? He'll go out there and run, and he finally managed to run all 5 miles without stopping. Does he stop there? No. He tries to do it again and push a little bit more. He tries to do it again, get his speed a little bit more. You know? So finally, you've handled all you can in a situation. You finally stepped in, handled it, blew your top, whatever goes on. You know what? See if you can push further next time. See if you can make it go further next time. See if you can't endure just a little bit longer. By long suffering, by kindness. Old fashioned kindness. Just being nice to people. Okay? Old fashioned kindness, where you just... Is there anybody here who despises people that have been kind to them? You despise people that have been kind to you?
Some people.
Well, why is that?
I don't know, just the way they do it.
Okay, so you think the kindness, though, if the way they're doing it, you think the kindness is maybe...
Probably false.
Yeah, okay. Well, nobody likes that. That's right.
That's how they are all the time.
Yeah. Nobody likes saccharine sweetness. You know, everybody likes genuine sweetness, all right?
Sweetness?
Saccharine, an artificial sugar.
Yeah.
Artificial sweetener. Saccharine kindness is, oh, Sonny, how are you doing? And they don't care how Sonny's doing. That's just how they talk. That's right. And nobody, you're right. Nobody likes that. You know, there's the old saying that there is no substitute for sincerity. Once you can fake that, you got it made. That's an old politician statement. There's no substitute for sincerity. Once you can fake that, you got it made. God forbid you ever be in that thing, all right? And you know what? Sometimes it takes a long time to know if somebody's sincere. It takes a long, long time. If you ever read the book, Fox's Book of English Martyrs, there's a story in there most of Fox's Book of English Martyrs talks about the period of time when Bloody Mary, Mary Tudor, takes the throne over, and she has 300 Protestants burned at the stake. And in one of those cases, it was an older man who they gave the chance to renounce Protestantism. They came to him and said, look, if you'll just take an oath to follow the Catholic Church, we won't do this. Well, some people came up and said, flee. All you got to do is flee, get to France and to Switzerland, you'll be free. And he said, no, when I was a young man I did that, during Henry VIII's time. He said, I came back when Edward VI took over. And he said, I don't intend to flee anymore. So then they came to him and said, well, sign this. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. So he had to go to London for trial. He went to London for trial and he was sentenced to be burned at the stake. Awful death. And by that sentence, the very sheriff who brought him by the warrant had to go back to his home parish, his hometown. You have to burn in the middle of your hometown. And so, you know, it's a long trip. It took about 3 days. They're traveling by horse, and he's going back. And finally, they're coming to the outskirts of his parish, and there's an inn there. And they go into the inn, and the innkeeper's wife is weeping as she's feeding him his food. And he said, ma'am, why are you weeping? You were always my biggest critic in this town. You were always the one who gainsaid everything I ever said. And she said, because I never believed you were true. I always believed you were a phony. And now you're going back of your own will to burn at the stake for what you believe. And I see how wrong I was. So sometimes it takes a long time to convince certain people. Some people might catch on right away. Others have been burned so many times in life that you're not going to convince them instantly. Right. You're not going to show them instantly. That's not going to happen. It's going to take a long time. And all it would take is one mistake. Mm-hmm. And you've said it all back over again. Okay? One mistake. All right. So by kindness, one of the greatest things you can do. Then he says by the Holy Ghost. In other words, by the power of God.
That's right.
Having what God wants. Having what God does. I'm going to make this statement. Jody called me yesterday, deeply troubled over the business meeting, and really spoke wisely. She spoke well and just had questions. Why was this? Why was that? And such. And again, all the illustration in the world why you try to keep peace.
That's right.
Okay? Because you're always going to have somebody who's sitting there not understanding what's going on. And you know what Jody said? She said, I wasn't sure how to vote, and I finally voted like my husband did. Wise thing. Okay? Now, there's certain things in a church. What color carpet should be, for example. God doesn't care what color carpet is. Okay? You know, whatever the majority wants, make the carpet that color. You know, and certain things God just doesn't care. It doesn't bother him. There's other things God cares deeply about. Very deeply about. When I came to this church 6.5 years ago on a Wednesday night, walked through those doors, I remember Mindy coming and opened the door first. We're here at 7 o'clock and no one's here. It was, at that time I had Daniel, Stephen, John, Mark, Timothy, Sam, Melissa was with us, Hannah, Ruth Ann, and we're standing there to go to church for, you know, Wednesday night church. And we first stopped. Dick and Margaret had been out in the yard. I'd stopped earlier and said, is this church still open? They said, yes. Are you members? No. Well, that told me a lot. It wasn't no, it was no. You know, and that's still, you know, you learn a lot on that kind of stuff. But we showed up at 7 and no one's there. Though we may be wrong, and then Mindy comes skipping along, and she opened the door, and, oh, my dad will be here pretty soon. And, you know, then Paul came in, and, you know, Paul never met a stranger in his life. He talked to us, and you know, and such. And
that's Paul, yeah.
Then, you know, I think Jerry Feister came in and said, Jerry never missed a service.
No, shoes, yeah.
Jerry Feister never missed a service ever. And in fact, used to have to fight her husband over it because he didn't like her come to all the services, but she never missed a service. Dick Harbeck ended up coming. Ken Stanton finally showed up. Ken was completely grubby from work and such, didn't have his teeth in, but I did not despise that. I actually have a lot of respect for a man who comes straight from work, you know, to preach. Wouldn't have bothered me at all if he had had cow dung on his boots and stepped in the altar, you know, stepped up the pole. That would not have prejudiced me for 5 seconds against a man of God, seeing him come in from real work and preaching. But of course, he whispered a melody for about 6 minutes, as I remember, and we sang a song, and then everybody went to pray, and the men went back in this back room, and we had plenty of room. Went back there, and how many people remember when the men went back there to pray? Yeah, and there was plenty of room, and but we went back there to pray, and Paul said to me, "Would you be our pastor?" And Ken Stanton liked to swallow whatever teeth he had left. And I said, "Well, you have a pastor." "Well, oh, he's just an interim here. He's supposed to find us a pastor." And Ken said, "Well, that's right. So we come out and we talk. Everybody leaves and Ken said, "I need to talk to you." I said, "Okay. Please don't take this church." "Why is that?" And he said, "Because I can't afford to lose this job. They give me $100 a week. I can't afford to be without it." And I remember thinking to myself, "Buddy, that's the least worry you have in the world, is that I'm coming out in the middle here. All right, I just finished my book. I just got my doctorate. There's the last thing I'm going to do is come out. No one's ever heard of Belfast, New York. No one's ever heard of Cuba, New York. They're 14 miles apart, and this is in between them, all right?" And, I had no intentions whatsoever of taking this church. And Paul then points over to the parsonage. "You can even have a place to live." "Yeah, that's real attractive there, Paul. You know, that house there, that'll really put, put some honey out there to get the flies, Paul. That'll do it."
"Okay, time out. That's like the Ivory Palace. Hello."
"Yeah, well, that's right. For Jody and Chris, they, yeah.
Presidential suite."
"Yeah." So we go home, and the next morning I'm praying, and the Lord sees my heart. "No, you will go. You will take that church, okay?" Now, what is that? What's that mean, the Lord sees my heart? What's that mean? What's that mean where suddenly I'm standing there and I just know from God that I have to go up there and I have to take that church? What's that mean? So Paul says, by the Holy Ghost, where you get something from God, okay? And that's why I told the folks, I don't care how you vote. If I got to go preach in that field, I'll go preach in that field.
That's right, bro.
Okay?
Yes, sir.
I don't care how you vote. And the Lord showed me to take the church. And, and if I'd preached in the field, I'd have gotten a crowd to go out there and I'm going to preach in the field. I remember the first year I was here. I said, "You can vote me out. I'll go preach in the field.
That's right.
It's not going to bother me." Okay? Why? Because it's by the Holy Ghost. Something the Lord showed me. Okay? Now, last April, when I first heard that Pastor Hain was getting ready to retire, out there walking up and down and praying, the Lord showed me exactly how to handle him. Exactly. There was no doubt this was from God. The very same God that showed me exactly that I'm to church showed me exactly how he was to be handled. This is exactly what's to be done. And there's people who don't know that. I'm not angry at people who don't know that. Not angry at all. There's people who went, Bob voted no, like a color of a carpet. You know, in other words, I hadn't told you that, had I? No. All right, but it's one of those things, and that's why for the first time, it's the very first vote that we've ever been here, where I broke the rule of unanimity.
You're right.
Okay, I've never let a vote go forward here that was not absolutely unanimous, but I did on that.
That's right.
Okay, why? Because out there God showed me exactly what to do. Okay, exactly. And let's just put it this way, go visit 1,000 churches where a pastor's taken over, and see if you can find one where when a pastor's built it up, he's treated the original stock as well as I have.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. See if you can find one.
Okay? Absolutely.
See if you find anywhere where I've given as much voice, bent over backwards, and I didn't take that vote, but I didn't go to each of their houses and talk to them. Okay? And, all right. So by the Holy Ghost, and then by love unfeigned. Anybody can fake love.
That's right.
Okay. In fact, if you think about it, that's nothing makes people more miserable in life than fake love. You're always wondering, is this sincere or not sincere? Is that sincere? Is that not sincere? It's unfeigned love. Not many people ever have anyone in their life that they just got unfeigned love from. Okay? Where there was just no fooling. They really, this person was for me. This person wanted me. This person loved me. This person cared for me. Unfeigned love. And that's why Jesus Christ said, no greater love hath any man than to lay down his life for his friend. What could ever show you more unfeigned love than somebody that would die for you?
Yeah, amen.
All right, somebody would do something of that sort. An unfeigned love. Then he says this, verse 7, by the word of truth. Okay? All these, talk about all the things that he uses in the ministry. The word of truth. Got a Bible. Got it out here. Okay? By the word of truth. By the power of God. Okay? And again, I've told the Lord, the day you want to not show your power with my preaching and my prayer life and my ministry, I don't want to be a pastor anymore. I'm not here to make a living. Okay? If I'm to make a living, there's other places you can make a living. I'm not here to make a living. Okay? And, I mean, a living's nice. I've never refused one. You know, but...
You could always be a truck driver.
Well, there you are, by golly.
Preach a truck driver.
You ever had me on the road, you wouldn't be one.
No.
You know, Bill Randall used to train...
doors.
Yeah. Bill Randall used to train all these preachers how to fly and everything when I was at Gethsemane. Somebody asked me one time, why don't you learn? I said, you ever been in the car with me?
No.
Bill Randall said, he ain't learning. Yeah, you know what you want? This ain't going to work. But by the power of God. Now watch this. He says, by the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left. Yeah, now, that's an interesting statement. By the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left, okay? Well, which part of the armor of righteousness, what part of the armor is righteousness?
Breastplate, isn't it?
The breastplate of righteousness, okay? All right? In another place, it's called the breastplate of faith and love. The armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left.
All the same.
That faith and love together, the right hand and on the left, is
but
what makes...
how you get God's righteousness by loving him and having the faith in him?
Yeah, that's right. That's it right. Takes the that's two right. together to make righteousness. By the armor of righteousness on the right hand and on the left, that faith and love.
Hmm.
That armor of righteousness.
So where does that leave all the other armor pieces?
Where were they supposed to
get be? Waiting to be put on?
Yeah.
Right.
That, you don't put your underwear in your head. You don't put your shoes on your ears. Well, you might, but we don't. All right? Don't look shocked. All right?
Yeah.
But it's just like the armor. Everything's got to go in the right place. All right. The only person I've ever seen shocked over that. All right. Verse 8.
Oh, boy.
By honor and dishonor. Go get her some paper towel. Said all she can handle. There's a, by golly, she done snorted her coke.
You can't snort the dang stuff. You gotta drink it.
Quick, get the camera phones out.
Make sure no one ever finds out that Tanya just snorted a drink out her nose laughing. All right.
That's going on the website.
Oh, my goodness.
You need a bib, girl?
All right.
Watch the baby.
Do it.
Woo. Good catch. Speaking of.
Right.
All right. Yeah. Hey, I'll tell you what. We had fun with that one.
Yes, sir.
Verse 8, by honor and dishonor. You know, everybody wants to be honored in life. And if you think about it, you seethe over the places you've been dishonored. You seethe over it. It tears you up. Remember when you used to go to your in-law's house and they had all the subtle little hints, Dale doesn't work, Dale's not this and that. And he'd seethe over the dishonor of that, seethe over it. And there's always people who want to put you someplace lower or whatever else. And Paul said, but that's part of it, by honor and dishonor. Time's treated like a common criminal, like a common crook, and like you're nothing and like you're dirt and you're scum. Dishonor, okay? And if you can't take that, don't be serving our God.
That's right, boy.
Okay? By evil report and good report. There's times people are going to say the most horrible things about you. You don't want them to be true, but they're going to say them.
They do.
Okay?
Yeah, don't stop them.
No, that's right. And it, you know what, it tears me up sometimes to hear some of the stuff that will be said. And I just have to remind myself, just shut your mouth.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's a hard lesson right there.
Mm-hmm.
I received a letter from somebody about a month and a half ago about a group of people that nobody here knows. And just tell me what a terrible group of people they were in this church. Boy, they're this, they're that. I had to leave because of that. And it was sent to me by a friend of mine. And to be honest, it was a mistake that he wrote it. I understood his feelings, okay? But it was a mistake. Later on, the guy's pastor got a hold of him, and he said, I feel terrible. I heard you got this letter. I said, leave that letter alone. I said, because a half-truth debated becomes a full-truth. A half-truth debated becomes a full-truth. Someone makes a half-truth, and you go argue about it, and all you do is settle it in everybody's mind that it's a full-truth. Leave it alone.
Oh, that's good.
Leave it alone.
You know, you said that multiple times, but, and I always didn't quite understand it, but there's this guy who got kicked out of CCC on different accusations, and he's been going every week down to Wellspring. Well, they said this, they said that. And I was sitting there last Friday, and he was going at it again, and everyone would agree with him. As soon as they walked away, though, you could see.
That's right, he's telling on himself. You know, one of my most famous stories on that, when I first got to Gethsemane, it was 1980 when I first showed up there, just a young man, wanting to learn to preach. And Mark, a man had just left. And he had left, he had been Bill Randall's associate pastor. And this guy at one time had been the road manager for Led Zeppelin. He was a man who, in fact, it's a funny story because his wife had been really in love with a guy in high school who decided he wanted to be a preacher, and she broke up with him because she wasn't going to be a preacher's wife. She ended up marrying this other guy who was a manager for Led Zeppelin, and that's about the safest place you could be if you don't want to be anywhere near preachers or anything. And he ended up getting saved and being a preacher, and she was a preacher's wife anyway. But the thing was, he'd been under Bill Randall for a while, and he left. Went to Florida. And, you know, I just got there in the vacuum. This guy had just left. And Bill Randall always spoke so highly. Boy, this guy, this. And you know, he just kept building him up on this platform. And what a tremendous guy this guy must be. Well, about a year later, I had to go down to Miami for something. And was at a church. And here's this guy. And I even got to hear him preach. And I thought, wow, Bill Randall's just talked good about him. So we go to have coffee afterwards. He says, look, I know all the stuff Bill Randall said about me, but I'm going to tell you the truth about it. And he began to tell me the story from his side. And all of a sudden I thought, you idiot, how could I have been so dumb not to realize that there had been a rift when he left? And everything this guy said, he went from being a giant to just shrinking to about this big in front of me. Because suddenly everything Bill Randall had never said became obvious to me. It became just, and here Bill Randall had done nothing but talk good about him. Nothing. And all of a sudden, he just shrunk down to like this in front of me. And I thought, buddy, you never know what you just did.
That's right.
If you had just shut your mouth, you would have been a giant in my life for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Instead, he just became this little teeny little... And Bill Randall became a huge giant to me. The worst thing you can do sometimes is run around trying to defend yourself from all the accusations.
That's right, brother. Yes, sir.
My attitude is this. If God won't defend me, then I ain't worth defending. And if God will defend me, what could I do better?
That's right.
Okay.
How small towns work, though.
Well, I'm in a small town, okay? And I've already had all the nonsense and the junk and everything said that could be said, okay? I sat in a woman's house who told me, I don't like your dirty mouth in the pulpit. Okay, because I'll say some pretty frank stuff in the pulpit. Because what I am here is what I am at home, what I am at work, right, and what I am in the pulpit, right. There ain't two of me.
That's right.
So I don't like your dirty mouth in the pulpit. She made this statement. She said, I have a granddaughter that I would never, ever let sit in your church because of the stuff you say. 2 years later, I was rescuing her granddaughter because her own daddy was tapping her. Okay. Now, you know what? Just leave it alone. Just let it go. Okay? I got people. Dick Botens always talk about certain people. He almost dreads them coming to the house because they're just going to come to the house and just run me down everywhere they can. And it don't bother me. I'll see you in giant. How you doing? Good to see you, sweetheart. It ain't going to bother me, all right? I go back to what Dick Gregory said. Dick Gregory, the black civil rights leader from the 1960s. He just, somebody would stand there and scream at him, nigger! And he would just say, all right, if a man calls a horse a cow, Did the horse just become sick, or is the man sick? Okay? And he said, I just want to know, when people throw words at you, it doesn't change who you are. It just shows what they are. Okay? Leave it alone. Now, if you attack my ministry or my people, I'm going to give you a hard time. Okay? You attack, you know, me as a pastor here or whatever else, and, you know, my ministry, and you attack me as a person, have at it. I'd give you more fodder than you ever heard of, all right? I'd tell you stuff that's more low down about me than you ever dreamed, all right? And when we're done with that, I probably got lower stuff. I just can't remember it all at once. It's too depressing, all right? And what are you going to do to somebody like that? What weapon could you possibly form against somebody that doesn't care what you call them? Okay?
Yeah.
You realize, Randy, you'd be invincible.
Invincible.
Invincible if you didn't care what people said about you. Tanya, you'd be invincible. Invincible.
Hard lesson.
Yeah, nobody could ever, and you'd be invincible if you didn't care what anybody said about you.
Right.
Okay?
I never thought of it like that.
That's right, you're invincible. There's nothing they can do.
That's right, man.
You know, how many times, some of the men have heard me go through this thing. It's amazing. You know, what'd you just scream at your wife for and break the front door? Well, she said this to me. Oh, you little wimp. You know, she said that to you. Oh, poopsie. I feel so bad for you, poopsie. You know, she said that to you. But it takes a while for me to get men to think like men, okay? It takes a while. Most of them are gelded by society and everything else out there. And, you know, and it's, but it's one of those things. Camille Paglia does a lot of writing for Salon Magazine and different places like that. And she's an extreme liberal and a lesbian. And she wrote a tremendous article on why America's destroying masculinity and what a mistake it is. Losing part of the flavor of America. And I thought, if even old Camille sees it, it's got to be pretty obvious, okay? But the thing is, I have to take men, and some of you have heard this before, but I'll tell them, I said, I want you to imagine for a moment you're sitting at a bar. I got men in here, that's not hard for you to imagine, others it would be hard, but all right. You're sitting at a bar, and got your beer in front of you, and there's a guy sitting on the bar stool next to you. He's about the biggest man you've ever seen. He almost takes up, needs two bar stools, and it ain't fat. I mean, he's just big. And sitting there, he's got wrists about as big around as your waist. Big old jaw and a beard on there, you know, and he's sitting there and drinking his beer. And for whatever reason, you've decided you need to take him out. For whatever reason, you've decided you got to do it, okay?
I never did that.
Yeah. Your face looks like good enough that I can see you never did. But you just decide you got to do it. Maybe you've got a roll of quarters in your pocket, you know, maybe a bag of, you know, salt or a little, you know, detergent thrown in his eyes or something of that sort. You know, Bill Randall, as you teach his boys, you know, you always have a bag of detergent or salt or something like that, throw it in their eyes first so you get the first three, four licks. But it's one of those things. So you think this thing out and you wait for the right moment and it all works. He looks at you, you catch him just as you dreamed you could catch him. His head snaps back, and then you stand up, take your stool, and whack it over his head. And then you take your beer bottle and smash it across his face. And he turns around and looks at you and says, "What'd you do that to me for?" And I always ask these guys, what's about to happen to you? And they know what's about to happen to them. And I said, now listen. Here's what's going on. You're at work, and your wife's sitting there all day long thinking about what she's going to say to you when you come in the door. That will all so-and-so. You know, he's so-and-so. He did this, he did that, everything else. And it's as low and dirty and everything else. You come walk through the door, you're tired, and she hits you with everything she's got. I mean, it's about your parents, it's about you, it's about everything you've ever done, everything you've ever said. It's all low. And you just look at her and say, you know, sweetheart, you're pretty. I'd give her a little kiss and walk on you.
Oh, that's classic.
You know,
the fight would be.
You are invincible.
My grandfather was like that.
Invincible.
My grandmother, they were all Yeah.
My grandmother was mad at him, and she was washing windows with a dirty dishcloth. And she got so mad, she threw the nasty dishcloth in his face, and he says, "Now, Dorothy, what'd you do that for?"
Yeah.
Exact words.
Invincible. You know? Instead of these wimpy little guys. Scream. Next thing you know, the cops are called. Get out of here.
That's right.
Be a man. Be a man. You know? Don't get into that nonsense. Yes?
However, nowadays, couldn't that be a little twisted? Because most guys I see now, they like it when they see a girl with a bad attitude.
Well, they pretend they like it, but most guys I know are godless little worms.
That's
right. You know.
Oh, I like when she does that, really.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I always remember a good friend of mine who, you know, I remember when we first had our first couple of babies, he and I used to street preach and that a lot together and such, and his wife and my wife would be together. We'd come home, usually if one guy had something for dinner, the other would. They're always cooking together, things of that sort, and everything. This guy was a really good friend of mine. At that time, you know, when I married Ruth Ann, I mean, she's a little bit tough. You know, a little bit of taming there to do, you know,
I could not imagine.
Yeah.
Oopsie, dinner's ready.
Yeah. You ask my boys what's like make her mad. She can hit you on that arm and get a black and blue mark like you ain't ever seen.
Well, and, he did give us the countless theory. Oh, come here, Rules.
Yeah. But the thing is, going through this stuff, and I remember my buddy's wife and them going through some stuff, and he never handled it right. Never. And I should tell him, that's not the way to handle it. And he just constantly didn't have that love for her, that care for her, and that kind of stuff. And eventually, their marriage blew to pieces. Eventually, it went south. And it just broke my heart when that thing. I mean, this was a really good friend. We'd street preach and stuff together. And you know, do a lot of stuff together, travel together. Now his marriage is busted apart. And finally, he quit coming to church and mad and got himself real into the martial arts and everything. And he used to be able to work out with two nunchucks at once. Never miss. I mean, between the legs, everything else. He used to stand there and 50 hits at a time hit bricks. His hands, this guy just a madman working out and such. And about 3 years later, I was driving by his trailer and the Lord just kept dealing with me. You need to go talk to him. You need to go talk to him. So I go into the house. Knock at the door. He's glad to see. In fact, he was watching one of his martial arts movies. Rock and roll blaring all over the place and such. He's just got a pair of shorts on. He's glistening. I mean, just absolute glistening sweat. Rippled. And I don't mean overburdened with muscles. I mean a guy that's really, you know, worked out that, you know, martial art type of thing. Glistening with that. And I said, well, I came to talk to you. And he's fine. And I began to talk to him. And he began to get real mad. He began to take his nunchucks and snapped them 1/4 inch from the bridge of my nose right there. Bang! Around behind his back. Bang! He's got two of them. They're going each hand. Bang! And I remember thinking to myself, I would rather die than not tell him what I have to say. So I finished, and I just thought to myself, I'd rather die than not say what I'm going to say. And bang! And finally when I got done, said everything, I said, now Bobby, I said, I know men in this town that can't bench press 90 pounds, but they can rule a woman. And then it went, and his head just hung. I left the room. Now, you listen to his son preach sometimes, Bubba. Okay? It goes back to this thing. There's something wrong with the soul of men. They just, and a man that can hit a woman is as low is a maggot.
That's right.
Lower than a maggot. A man that can hit a woman. Yeah. A man that can't love a woman. A man that can absolutely, who wouldn't lay down his life and die for her and such, and that she'd follow him anywhere. But it's just missing. I feel bad for most of the women out there. I feel bad for them. Love unfeigned. And goes on by honor and dishonor, by evil report and good report, as deceivers and yet true. As deceivers. You know, there's all sorts of people that look at a man of God like he's just fooling them, he's tricking them, he's doing this, he's doing that. And you look that way all the time. But Paul said, but as true. You look like a deceiver, but you're telling the truth. My son Stephen says this about me. He says, you know, Dad, he said, you're one of those people who will say something in a crowded room and everybody will look at you like you're a complete idiot. And then they'll go home and realize, oh, he was telling the truth. You know, yeah, that pretty well describes it. Okay. It's just, then he says, verse 9, as unknown and yet well known. You know, it's funny, earlier in my life, you know, I was just like most preachers, you know, called to preach, and you picture yourself in Madison Square Garden and preaching, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, anything I ever did to seek to be known by people never worked. But when I took the most obscure little church I could find anywhere in America, I'm more known now than I ever was before. Okay? As unknown, that you're well known by every angel in heaven. Mm. Known by a God that made everything. Okay? And what more could you ever want?
That's right.
Probably some of the greatest preachers we ever heard of, nobody's ever heard of. Okay? As unknown and yet well known, as dying and behold we live. People are constantly looking and say, boy, that'll ruin him. Boy, that'll shut him off. Boy, that'll destroy him. Boy, that'll ruin. And yet, you live again. You live again. You live again. The cat came back. We thought he was a goner, but the cat came back. Right? As chastened and not killed. Okay? Just watch the race. As chastened but not killed. Just, you know what? Because God's got a shorter leash on Dale right now, trying to get some stuff out of him, and there's a lot of stuff to get out of him, all right? And chastened and not killed. Randy?
Then how do you verify the holy leash, so to say?
I'm not sure what you mean by verifying the holy. Verify means to make true the holy leash.
Well, you just said God keeping Dale on a short leash.
That's right. Chastening him. In other words, constantly punishing him, constantly driving him low, constantly knocking him down, constantly doing that, okay? But he's not killed.
No.
He's making it out of it, okay?
Do I look like I get a lot of them?
No, that's a fair statement, Randy, you don't. Okay? Then he says this, as sorrowful yet always rejoicing. As sorrowful yet always... You know what? There's a lot to be sorrowful about. A lot of things in life right now to be sorrowful about, but always rejoicing because you've got a God that can handle every bit of it. Okay? Sorrowful yet always rejoicing, as poor yet making many rich. Okay? As poor yet making many rich. And there's nothing like that. You know, when God wanted to get a lot out of Gideon, he had to get him down to 300 men. In order to have the great victory. There's a lot of times when God's got to strip you of a lot of stuff you thought you needed to serve him. And then get the great victory. Okay? As poor, yet making many rich. As having nothing, yet possessing all things. Okay? You don't have a thing and yet you've got it all. I've got it made. I always remember, and people have heard me tell that story of walking up the Red Village Road in Vermont. And we hadn't been there but a month or two, and I'm picking up cans by the side of the road because we don't have a bit of money anywhere. It's a nickel for every can, and I got a baby that has to have some special formula and puke anything else. And I was feeling particularly low at one particular moment walking by this big business with the greenhouses and such. And I'm walking by that thing, and all of a sudden the song began to play in my heart. Don't think me poor nor deserted or lonely. I'm not discouraged. I'm heaven bound. Later on, when I got to know the couple, at that very moment, they were looking out the window saying, who is that man? Well, so I think he's that new preacher. And later on, they became the first family to join my church as a family. And they had one kid on the brink of divorce, getting ready to get rid of each other. Had seven kids, last I knew, homeschooled them all and played instruments, singing and such, with their lives all together. But it's that moment we walking by, picking up cans out of a ditch, because I can't even feed my own family, okay? And as poor, yet making many rich, okay? having nothing yet, possessing all things. Verse 11, O ye Corinthians, our mouth is open unto you, our heart is enlarged. In other words, hey, I'm trying to talk to you. Hey, I care for you. Ruth Ann used to sit sometimes at Gethsemane and just say, don't those people see that Bill Randall loves them? Don't they see it? Don't they see that? Don't they get that through their head? Okay. And, you know, and she, it used to frustrate her. She'd even say to him, and he'd say, sister, they don't see it. They don't see it.
Still don't.
Oh, and there's some that won't. Then he says this in verse 12. Be ye not, ye are not straitened in us. You're straitened in your own bowels. And we'll probably pick up with that next week. Straitened. When we think of the Straits of Gibraltar, what is that? It's a narrow place that you can sail out of the Mediterranean. The word straight there means narrow. Okay? Straitened. The Straits of Gibraltar. The Straits of Hormuz. Sure. You're not. It's not us that's made your life real narrow. It's not us that's done that. Your own bowels, meaning your deepest feelings, are doing that to your life, not us. Your deepest feelings are the ones narrowing you down like this. It's not us doing it. Your deepest inside feelings are doing that, not us. All right. Carrie, would you close us in prayer, please?
Our friends have been thinking.